Good evening to the this cabinet meeting on the 13th of February 2020. This meeting will be recorded and the sound recording subsequently made available via the Council's website. In addition, under the Local Authorities Executive Arrangements, Meetings and Access to Information England Regulation 2012, other people may film, record, tweet or blog from this meeting. The use of any such images or sound recordings is not under the Council's control. So first off, item one, we have apologies. We have no apologies. Item two, disclosures of pecuniary or personal interest. Are there any disclosures that anyone wishes to make? Nope, absolutely none. That's great. Thank you very much. I'm looking at Councillor Boker because of your hand. It's permanently up, and I'm wondering whether that's a permanent indication of wanting to say anything. Well, I'll wait for the other hand to go up instead.
It has to go up.
Okay. Thank you very much. Item three, leaders' announcements. I have no announcements to make this evening. Item four, minutes of the previous meeting. This is the meeting that was held on the 16th of January 2020. Any amendments or alterations that need to be made to those minutes? Everyone's happy with the content of those? I propose those? Everyone's happy? Seconded? Good. That's everyone. Thank you very much. Those are approved. Item five, questions under Cabinet Procedure 10.7. No questions have been submitted. So we're on to item six, which is the beginning of the substantive part of the meeting, which is the report from the Budget Scrutiny Panel. So very pleased to see, I think, Councillor Parsons, whose trains were running on time. So, Councillor Parsons, if you'd like to, you're eating a biscuit, aren't you? This is the wrong moment to be eating a biscuit. You thought you had time, but there is, in fact, no time. So Councillor Parsons is joining us at the table. Councillor Parsons is the chair of the Budget Scrutiny Panel. And we'll... No, you need to come to the next one. Admittedly, that does mean... No, because it needs to be recorded. It does, unfortunately, mean sitting next to Councillor Mercer, but he'll only tell you afterwards why that's a problem.
Don't worry if he starts coughing.
So, Councillor Parsons. So, by all means, over the next 4 or 5 minutes, if you want to run through... your report from the Budget Scrutiny Panel, then we'll have an opportunity to ask any questions of clarity to you. And at that point, if you want to retire from the table, and we'll then have an opportunity to ask questions and have a debate and pick up any points that we need to from Simon Jackson for clarity. Thank you very much. So if you can push your button so we can do the sound recording.
Thank you. Appreciate the opportunity to feedback tonight. I think on page 19, the introduction and the foreword gives a very brief overview of the position. I think Budget Scrutiny Panel remains or is concerned and will be seeking reassurance as we go through the process over the coming year. The recommendations, I'm very happy for you to ask questions about, but they are self-evident as the 10 recommendations. I would only point out and note that in the September meeting of the Budget Scrutiny Panel, we did reference very early the importance of the capital and treasury strategy to the budget position and to the budgets going forward and the MTFS. I think I remain concerned that the only place that those documents have appeared before tonight is with Scrutiny Commission for pre-decision scrutiny. No offence to that group, but that's a body wholly unqualified, as the Treasury strategy indicates that anyone involved with scrutiny of Treasury must be appropriately trained, for that to be the only place that the Treasury strategy, with some very substantive changes to what we knew beforehand. Audit Committee is cancelled next week, so Audit Committee will have no opportunity to look at it. So a brand new Treasury strategy, which is substantially different and substantially moved on, along with the capital strategy, will not have been scrutinised by a qualified body pre-council. And so I would only note that some of the comments about the clarity, the process, the timing of issues for scrutiny to do their job appropriately, in my view, continue. I'm very happy to receive questions on the panel recommendations and to let you know that Budget Scrutiny, CSS and Audit Committee will continue to work tirelessly to ensure that we do our role appropriately as best we can, given some of the issues with timing that we face.
Thank you very much, Councillor Parsons. So, councillors, are there any questions of clarity that anyone wishes to ask Councillor Parsons before he retires? No questions. Thank you very much. Clear report. Thank you very much. So, we've got Simon Jackson, who's available, who's our Strategic Director of Corporate Services, available for assisting with any questions that we may have. Councillor Barclay, can I ask you to open with any questions?
I think the Budget Scrutiny Panel have highlighted some genuine concerns. They're not issues which it won't be only the Budget Scrutiny Panel will be monitoring it, I will be as well, and so will Cabinet. I think very valid points. We know that we've got challenges to face us. We know that how we intend to address them. I'm not sure I agree that the overview and scrutiny is not capable of reading a paper and making comment on it. I think that's a bit unkind. I think commercial strategy that we intend to put in force is very clear. There's not really much ambiguity about it. And I think as a council and as a cabinet, the comments that have come from the Budget Scrutiny Panel are helpful. They give us guidance on an independent view. It's a view that I would concur with in many respects. I spent many happy hours in front of the Budget Scrutiny Panel. I think the points they've raised have been helpful, and I certainly wouldn't criticise it. But we have a plan, and we have to implement a process to a lot of the capital strategy, a lot of the treasury management strategy. Although there are changes, I wouldn't deem them to be massive changes. It gives the power of executive authority to the leader, to the which is already in many, many councils do it. But we know where we're going. We know what the plan is. Appreciate the work that they've put in, appreciate the time and consideration they've given, and we'll very much bear in mind what they've said.
Thank you very much. Are there any other questions anyone wishes to raise? It's a pretty thorough report. Councillor Spinovich.
So much a question, it's more a concern in that, I mean, I don't like underspends, but there have been times where there has been an underspend, and when I've queried it with a particular officer, the answer is quite valid in that if you try to tender for something and you don't get anybody responding to your tender and you have to widen your field, you've got an underspend because it hasn't come back in the time. So I'm assuming that there are reasons given when there is a significant amount of money to, you know, it's not a perfect world, as it were.
No, good point. Any other comments that anyone wishes to make? Otherwise, I'm going to pass back to Councillor Barclay to make a proposal.
Yeah, I propose that we move officer recommendations 1 to 10, full reasons set out on agenda page 12.
I will second that, Leader.
Thank you very much. Can I see all of those in favour? That's everyone. Thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you very much, Councillor Parsons, as well. Okay, we're now moving on to item 7, which is General Fund and HRA revenue budgets for 2020-2021. So I can see Leslie Tansey, our Head of Finance and Property Services, who's coming to the table now to assist with the report. As before, we're taking reports as read so that we can actually get to the meat of the questions a bit earlier. But obviously, any questions or clarity that anyone wishes to raise with Leslie, then we can do so. So can I ask Councillor Barclay to start off?
Right. Well, we have the budget in front of us. Essentially, we are raising council tax in total by £5 a year. We remain one of the lowest council tax charging authorities among the district councils in the country. We have a use of reserves of $975,000 in this budget. It is a balanced budget. We have to address that shortfall. One of the principal reasons why we are, we could have the need for use of reserves and why we built them up is because the reduction in new homes bonus, not this year, but next year, we're looking over the next 3 years to lose £3 million in funding from new homes bonus. We are maintaining services. You can see that the summary of the budget shows that we're in a sound position on the general fund, even at the end of this year. It's not so much this year I'm worried about, it's future years. We have total balance of about £7.7 million. The HRA is in a strong position. We do have a HRA financing fund, which will be used to repay the £79 million borrowing. So we're building up so that we can repay the tranches. And I know that's one of the concerns the Budget Scrutiny Committee raised, but we have substantial funds put aside. The money that we've borrowed is matures in tranches over 30 years, at the lowest interest rates over the last 300 years. We locked into those. So we're in a position to be able to do that. Overall, the Section 151 officer is happy with the budget as it stands. I think he's highlighted the concerns, the uncertainties there are in terms of government funding, and that's not particularly unusual. We've come through some very difficult times. But I will hand over to Leslie and see if she wants to add anything else.
Thank you, Councillor Barclay. That was a comprehensive introduction. I've not really got much more to add to that. So I'll take any questions, if anybody's got any questions on the report itself.
Can I ask... No. Leslie had the button on. Can I ask whether any questions on the budget and HRA? So it is... Can I ask, Leslie? I mean, it obviously is a challenging budget. The important thing about the budget is actually setting out... the reality, but also some of the parameters that we're hopefully dealing with as far as how we can actually get the budget back into line in the future. Of the challenges within the current budget, are there any in particular that are wholly reliant on third party other than government funding, or are all of the challenges that we face within our control?
Thank you, Councillor Morgan. The budget, as Councillor Barclay's just introduced, is we obviously have got this £1 million shortfall, and that's obviously with the budgets as they are. I think going forward, we obviously have an increase in costs, so we have got to take that into account when we're looking at the MTFS. We are going to look at, obviously, the medium-term financial strategy, and we've got a plan in place to recover the balance, to get the budget back in balance by sort of commercialisation, possibly looking at some service reductions. But as Councillor Barclay said, for 2020, there's no changes to the services. Thank you.
Thank you very much for confirming that. That's good. Any other questions that anyone wants to raise or any other points? It is a very detailed report, covers, I think, all the areas. Obviously, we've had a great deal of discussion on this item over the last few months, and I think this is a very good summary of where we are, knowing full well what we know. So, Councillor Barker, can I pass back to you to make a proposal?
So, I propose recommendations 1 to 14 on pages 37 and 38 of the report for the reasons 1 to 14 on pages 38 and 39 of the report.
Thank you very much. Councillor Furlong, can I ask you to second? Oh, sorry, apologies. It was Councillor Boker who was going to second, I think. No, it wasn't. It was Councillor Furlong. Sorry, apologies.
Oh, it's me. I'm just nervous that nobody's going to second it.
It has been seconded. Do you want to say?
Are we there? Yeah, we're there. I'd like to second it.
Okay, thank you very much. We've had a proposal, we've had a seconder. Can I see all of those in favour? That's everyone. Thank you very much. Councillor Mercer, was your hand up or down? It was up. Okay, thank you very much. That's everyone. Leslie, thank you very much as well. So you're going to stay with us, hopefully, for the next item as well. Or are you? No, you're moving on, are you?
Leader, I'm going to lead on the capital strategy, so I'll sort of initially help, but there are some details in there which Leslie is better placed to answer. So Leslie's going to stay for this one, and then the capital plan, she'll deal with the details. So she's here for a couple of items, that's okay.
In that case, please do not move. So we're now on to item 8, which is the capital strategy, treasury management strategy statement, and the annual investment strategy and minimum revenue provision policy for 2020-2021. So as Simon has just said, he's going to help with some of the questions along with Leslie, who's still with us. So I'm going to ask Councillor Barclay to open the discussion, and then we'll pass over for discussion.
Yes, so basically this capital strategy is a requirement that's been on put on us, and this is the second one that we produced. It encompasses how we view our capital investments going forward over the next year. And it also brings into play the way that we calculate what we need to put aside. If we make a capital investment, the minimum revenue provisions, in other words, depreciation of the asset over the period that we've acquired it, it also takes into effect how we're going to manage the cash flow on our capital plan. The treasury management strategy includes some extension of the period we can invest in other local authorities, increases the limits on some of the investments. There is no huge risk there. Probably the major items that are changed are an amendment to increase the counterparty limits with HSBC, so we get more interest, to increase the counterparty limits on deposits and money market, to increase the maximum period we can go with the local authorities, and to add housing associations to the list of allowed non-specific investments. Now, the other item is to uplift the estimates of the capital financing requirement that we envisage over the next few years, and increasing the limits to be allowed and that allowed to be borrowed. It also addresses some of the needs in the appendices of, if we are to make commercial investment decisions, that we will need to react quickly. It'll become under an executive authority. It's not unreasonable. There are many, many other councils who've done this already. The decision will be made with professional advice and with very clear guidance on what our objectives are. There will be no, the decision will be made, the details of the decision will be available to all councillors, but the decision will be made on an executive authority as outlined in this paper here. I don't see this as a major departure or a complete change of direction. It's common sense. It's done for very, very good reasons, which you know, the budget process. This has been out again for pre-scrutiny, pre-cabinet scrutiny. It will be coming to council. Any concerns we can address there, but to me, it's very sound, it's sensible, it's what we need to do, it's logical, it's risk-aware rather than risk-averse. And a sound thing. It runs to 62 pages, and I hope you've all read it.
Thank you very much, Councillor Barclay. You're right. I mean, it is a detailed paper, and it covers a wide variety of different parts of our strategy. or strategy going forward, in particular the changes to the constitution that will be required under our investment strategy for commercial property, which is something that I think is quite rightly going to be of interest to all councillors. When we discussed this at the last council meeting, there were a couple of councillors, I think, who implied that any financial decisions related to commercial investment purchases should be referred back to full council before they actually complete. Now, obviously, I suspect that's incredibly impractical on the basis that building in such delays, whether it be call-in, but especially going back to full council, admittedly, given the size of the investments, it would still be highly impractical. But the provisions that are outlined here, I'm assuming, have been adopted by many other councils, and therefore this is not unusual. Can I ask that question to Simon?
Yes, thank you, Leader. Certainly, just addressing a couple of those points. In terms of timeliness, this may not necessarily feel comfortable for some councillors, but I think we're now getting a very good understanding by working with representatives from other authorities who've adopted exactly this sort of process, and that understanding shows us that from making a bid to completing a transaction, the timeline is sort of 10, 15, 20 days, and with our existing governance processes, it would be impractical to actually gather councillors together to make those sort of decisions in that sort of time frame. So what the proposals within the financial regulations that would be supported by the financial procedure rules and other rules are would enable us to achieve those timelines in an efficient manner. So that is what is being proposed in this document and which we are hoping will be approved by Council. I think we do recognise that transparency and sort of accountability is very important. So the quid pro quo, if you like, is that these things will naturally get reported to Council, but what we plan to do is have inspection or regular reporting to the Audit Committee, who will actually be able to look at the transactions, look at the transaction history, and look at them retrospectively, which is not necessarily what all councils would want, but I think it would fulfil our sort of transparency and accountability obligations and responsibilities, so all councils will have a chance to see what we're doing here. And actually, I may just refer to one of the things in the overarching cover report is some of the detail of this we're planning to bring to Cabinet next time round, which will cover the process we hope to go through in acquiring commercial property, some of the checklists and the due diligence that we would do, and then that will also cover the reporting and subsequently what will go to Council as a matter of course through the governance process, and also the reporting we would envisage doing through Audit Committee or potentially scrutiny, all that those sort of things are we would intend to do, and they can be subject to some sort of refinement as councillors might prefer.
Thank you very much. Councillor Barclay.
Yeah, I read somewhere that the councils, in the last year, the amount of investment in commercial property has gone up by 14 times by councils. I mean, the process we're putting in place is really to enable us to achieve the commercial investment. It's not to move by subterfuge or anything like that. It's just commercially, if we do not have the ability to act in a timely fashion, we won't be getting anywhere.
Yes, I would agree with that. The opportunities that come to our door, if we are restricted to our standard or existing governance arrangement, we will just simply not be able to compete on a process and the required completion timeline required of the vendors.
Got questions from Councillor Rawlings, Councillor Taylor and Councillor Harper-Davies. So if I take Councillor Rawlings.
Thank you. Just looking at the amendments to the financial regulations part of the Constitution, I'm just curious as to why we're saying for commercial purchases it will be the leader that has delegated authority or a cabinet member that he gives authority to, but for sales we're saying it will be the leader or the lead member for finance. Would it not make sense for it to be the leader or the lead member for finance in both cases, purchase or sale? So if the leader's ever not available, the lead member for finance can take a decision in his absence without specific authority from the leader on that particular occasion.
Yes. No, I think in fairness, there's some drafting points. It is actually, ultimately, the leader will draft the executive decision, assuming all this is agreed, and actually whether it's the lead member for finance or some other cabinet member, it is a question of taste and might be a question of actually which cabinet members feel they've got the skills and capacity to be able to take these decisions. So it is something, it is actually ultimately a leader decision. So, you know, possibly the drafting of the report could have been slightly clearer on that point. So yes is the answer, but there is some flexibility within that.
I did think for a moment there Simon was going to give the shortest answer he'd ever given. but in principle, I think yes is the right answer. But I appreciate it's how it's drafted at the moment. It is in line with all delegations, therefore it's a standard delegation. But I think in principle, I think your point, Councillor Rawlings, is absolutely right, that consistency probably is quite useful. Councillor Taylor.
Thank you, Leader. Just on paragraph 47 on page 71 about properties, acquisitions will generally be outside of the borough. Just really, will we still be looking within the borough as well, or are we looking more outside? Just some more detail about that, please.
Again, I could go with yes as the answer. So yes is the answer on that one. I think the reason for maybe focusing or preferring things outside of the borough is that we can be very clear that we are operating completely commercially with those acquisitions. If there's something inside the borough, then what may happen is that our landlord and commercial hat, which we would be wearing in making these property acquisitions, is diluted by other factors that we may be tempted to take into account. So, for example, if a tenant comes to us and says, sorry, we can't pay the rent, and if you force us to pay the rent, we'll be closing the site down, and with the loss of jobs, etc., it can be quite difficult. So I think there is a desire or an aspiration to invest in the borough, and we've clearly got some sort of regeneration and keen to grow the borough. I think the way to manage that is to have potentially separate pools of funding, and we can set aside separate capital allocations for those regeneration growth aspirations we have, and keep that separate from the commercial property fund, which I think is a way we'll manage it. Having said that, if the right opportunities do come up within the borough, there's no reason that they would we would be disbarred from considering them purely on the basis of this property. I think it's purely on the basis of this policy. I think the main point really is we don't want to restrict ourselves to be investing inside the borough, and actually recognising that in terms of future management of issues, investing outside of the borough may be more straightforward in some circumstances.
Thanks a lot. Councillor Harper-Davis.
Thank you, Leader. I was just going to say, actually, I think it's an amazing opportunity for us, and I think when we think back to the last peer review we had regarding how we work as a council in a probably less than timely manner, I think giving delegated authority to whoever, leader or deputy leader or delegated lead member, I think if we don't enable this to happen, then we miss the good opportunities of a commercial investment. So I was just going to say, I think it's moving with the times. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Good comment. Councillor Mercer.
Simon, can I ask, in assessing the risk, did you see what the National Audit Office said yesterday about the way in which councils were possibly overexposed in the property market, and that there was a significant risk with a property crash or a recession? Is that something that you've taken into account?
I suppose, in fairness, the report was drafted before the advice from the National Audit Office became apparent, but I think that was something we were aware of. There is a question of proportionality, so to what extent your commercial property investments relate to the size of the council as a whole. So there are one or two well-known examples where the commercial property portfolio is well in excess of the size of the council, so that is disproportionate, and that is something that the relevant authorities are looking at. I think with this topic and this subject, it's actually pretty binary. So we can talk about national averages and how things and what what the national numbers are, but for us, whatever those numbers are, if we get it right, which is clearly what we want to do, then things will go well. If we get it wrong, whatever the numbers say, then that will be a disappointed, and we'll have to have a careful look about what goes wrong. I think for me, the main thing is to make sure we know what we're doing and we have a very clear idea about what we're doing when we're identifying, assessing and assessing properties and making the decision to buy them or not. And I think that's, again, I think that's something we can maybe discuss in more detail, hopefully at the next cabinet meeting when we have the relevant report. But I think the key thing is, do we know what we're doing and having the skills, capacity and expertise that enables us to do that? And then when we having discussed that, I hope that we can provide the assurance we need on the individual case-by-case basis, which in reality is how we will be hopefully building up our commercial property portfolio.
Councillor Barclay.
Yeah, I just to get some sort of reassurance, we will be dealing with a professional advisor who will advise us on details, somebody who has experience in the commercial property market. We won't be just doing this on a whim. We will go into it in great detail and take advice. Is that correct?
Yes, absolutely. There's absolutely no guarantees with any of this. Maybe the good thing is we're slightly late to this particular activity than some others, so we are able to learn lessons from some of those others, so around proportionality and around what sort of sectors and things to avoid. So there are one or two case studies out there. But I think for me the key thing is to have a clear strategy, a clear approach, and make sure we've got the right professional advice and skills to enable us to make quality decisions.
Councillor Boland.
Thank you. I think in the environment that local government's been in for the whole of my time in it, and well before, in terms of ever increasingly difficult financial situations, having to cut more efficient, I think really this is a no-brainer in the sense that we've got to start growing. How can we bring in money as well as making increasing efficient? So I think this is certainly something that is an absolutely good thing for us to do. In terms of what we're investing in, I was just wondering, obviously, if we were just independent capitalists investing in whatever would make us the most money possible, we might make some decisions. As a local authority, are there any sort of considerations we have even outside the borough beyond what will give us the biggest yield? I mean, a silly example, we find an armaments factory or something up for sale. Do you know, is it those sorts of considerations, or is it really just cold hard capitalism?
Yeah.
I think that would be part of the due diligence process. So I think part of the due diligence process is looking at the tenants. So generally, as a general rule, we would be looking to buy properties with existing tenants. So we would be looking to buy the freehold of the property. We would look actually the activities of that property to be undertaken by the tenant, and also the repairs and insurance of that property. So we wouldn't have anything to do with that. But as you say, if the tenant was an arms manufacturer animal, it would experiment on animals, then that's clearly something we would consider as part of the due diligence process, as part of the pack of information that would form our decision-making audit trail. Then that would be highlighted, and if there was something that we didn't like as a council, that would be a political steer from actually relevant cabinet members making that decision. And in terms of what returns and what properties, again, it would be on a case-by-case basis. But as with all of these things, you're considering risk and return. So I suppose if the price is right and there's nothing ethically wrong with it, I guess anything could be considered. But obviously, things like shopping centres are, very high risk, and they're the sort of things we probably wouldn't look at. But I think it has to be considered on a case-by-case basis, really.
Councillor Roggs.
Probably slightly off topic, but you just mentioned insurance then. I'd be incredibly nervous if we, as the owner of the property, weren't the one actually insuring it, and I'd expect probably whatever leases we look at would include an obligation for us to insure as the landlord to make sure that we've got complete control over that. And of course, in most cases, the tenant would end up paying for the insurance policy anyway. But I just think that probably ought to be part of the process as well, to make sure that we've got control over what would become our asset.
I think this is something we would take the detailed advice on, but my understanding is we would specify what insurance is required of the building, and then we would require, as part of the lease agreements, the tenants to take out the insurance in line with our specifications, and I guess we check that they would do that. So it is fairly standard within the industry for tenant repairing and insuring leases. So that is actually a standard level of terms and conditions, but as part of that we would specify the insurance and make sure that they paid up the insurance policy so that the building was insured in line with our exact specification and requirements. But that's some of the detailed advice we will take as we're sort of developing our portfolio and entering into any transactions that we believe are appropriate.
More detail to follow, I think, is probably the outcome. Any other further questions? In that case, can I ask Councillor Barclay to make a proposal, and I will follow that through.
I make a recommendation. Let me just have a look and see. So recommendations 1 to 5 on page 53 and 54 for the reasons 1 to 5 on page 54.
Thank you very much. I'd like to second that. So can I see a show of hands? All of those in favour. Thank you very much. Thank you. So we're now on to item 9, which is the new capital plan 2020-21 to 2022-23. So I'm going to go straight to Councillor Barclay and ask for an introduction.
So this is our brand new capital plan. Doesn't take effect of the previous capital plan. It's just what our strategy is over the next 3 years. The plan shows that we've got plans to invest $9 million from the general fund and from the HRA, roughly $22 million. The full details, specific details, are given on after page 121, 22, 23. All of these proposals will be completely assessed through the capital planning process before they are brought forward. But the plans and the initial outlay that is anticipated will be there, but they will be monitored through the normal process. Eventually, any residual from the previous capital plan will be carried forward. And perhaps I could ask in our introduction if the Head of Financial Services could just explain the process of how we're going to transfer that money over from the old capital plan into the new one. Thank you.
Thank you, Councillor Barclay. Just to add then, the new capital plan for 2020 to 2023, there's no changes to the actual detail of the report since the draft report to Cabinet on the 16th of December. Just to answer your question, we will be merging the current capital plan, so we'll be bringing forward $10 million that's already been approved for commercialisation that's in the current plan, and we're bringing forward the $4.8 million of the fleet purchase that's in the current capital plan. And then in terms of the year-end, we'll be doing a year-end process where we'll be putting together a report that will be presented to SLT on the 22nd of April to list down all the slippage from the current capital plan into the new year. And we'll present a merged capital plan of the two items together. Thank you.
Thank you very much for that. Obviously, as Leslie's just confirmed, we've seen the draft version of this through Cabinet before, and no changes, substantial or otherwise. So any questions on this document that otherwise you didn't wish to raise on the draft version? No questions. So in which case, I'm going to pass back to Councillor Barclay.
So I make a recommendation the new capital plan for 2020-21 to 22-23 for the General Fund and HRA scheme set out in Appendix 1 is approved and recommended to Council. For the reason, the new capital plan becomes the basis for capital spending by the Council for the next 3 years.
Thank you very much, Councillor Barclay. Councillor Rawlings, can I ask you to second?
Thank you, Leader. I'm happy to second this item.
Thank you very much. Can I see all of those in favour? Thank you very much. As our Chief Executive has just pointed out, there are obviously some extraordinarily good items across the whole of the borough, so we'll make sure now that hopefully our comms team can actually promote what we're actually doing as a council for our residents. So if I can move on to thank you very much, Leslie, for that as well. I think you can possibly leave us now if you wish.
No, you're okay to leave.
Yep. Yes. flee while you can. So we're now on to item 11. Item 10 is the withdrawn items. We're now on to item 11, which is the strategic risk register. We have with us Adrian Ward, who's our head of strategic support, to assist with any questions or queries. Otherwise, we're going to pass over to Councillor Poland, who will hopefully introduce the item ahead of any discussion.
Thank you, Leader. So, as members will know, this is strategic risk register is an annual item required by law to bring it to Cabinet every year. It's an annual thing. We did quite a bit of work on this last year in terms of changing the risks following, I think it was the peer review that we had, sort of 2019, I think it was, maybe in 2018. But this is very much a continuation of what we've had before. So no need to particularly go on about that. So just open it up for questions.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much for that introduction. I was going to open with one question. Which was actually about business continuity. We talk about business continuity, obviously, as an organisation and our the functions that we carry out. The question I was really going to ask was about business continuity if, for some reason, our democratic side can't actually, or our democratic bodies can't actually meet. Obviously, we have a situation in China at the moment where meeting is people coming together is obviously been banned. If something of a similar nature happened in this country for whatever reason, whether it's that or something else, as an organisation, what continuity do we have to actually carry on our democratic functions?
Thank you, Leader. That's an interesting question. I think I would need to do a bit more research into what the legal situation was, but as the law stands at the moment, there is a legal requirement that for local authority meetings to be valid, councillors participating in the meeting, debating and voting actually need to be present in the room, so there is no provision within the law at the moment to have video conferencing meetings or any sort of remote way of accessing meetings. Whether the government would enact emergency legislation to enable that to happen, obviously I can't speak for that, but it's something I'd need to do a bit more research on and get back to you, Leader, if that's okay.
Maybe to ask a question of the LGA, but also MHCLG, that would be quite helpful, because if we are needing to invest in facilities that would allow us to actually do video conferencing in the event that that was actually one of the ways to actually carry on functioning, then by all means, alternatively, if there are other changes to the Constitution that need to be considered that would tally with any emergency legislation. Okay. Any other questions that anyone wishes to raise? Councillor Taylor.
Just looking on page 131 about financial risks, obviously our risk appetite's changing slightly with our commercialisation, but nothing's changed within the risk register. So I just want to see if that's been considered and whether that's had an impact.
Through you, Leader, that's a very valid point. Obviously, the commercialisation arrangements are working their way through the system at the moment and are still subject to member approval. The strategic risk register is a living document. It is something that corporate management team review on a quarterly basis. It's also something that, although Cabinet only see it annually, the audit committee also review it. on a quarterly basis. So I think when we come to do the next quarterly review, assuming members give approval for the commercialisation arrangements, we will probably need to amend that risk, add it in, and maybe rescore the likelihood and impact accordingly.
Councillor Mercer, you have a question.
Thank you. Leader, we saw what happened with what I think was a small software fault to the phone systems. Over the past year, the number of ransomware attacks on companies and more significantly on the public sector, particularly in the States, has increased dramatically. And there have also been a lot of data breaches, even affecting companies such as Amazon and Microsoft, which one would have thought would be able to protect themselves against that. That threat is increasing. Does your assessment of the risk, which I don't think has altered from last year, does that reflect the fact that IT have hardened their systems or that it just hasn't been reassessed in view of the escalating threat?
I think it is, as Councillor Musk points out, it's a growing risk. It's going to continue to grow. I do know our colleagues in the IT department are regularly reviewing and updating our IT security arrangements in line with recommendations from relevant professional bodies. We do also have an annual penetration test where we actually employ expert professionals to, in a controlled way, hack our systems and see what they can get up to and what they can find out and what potential havoc they could wreak if they weren't quite so professional. That we have always come out reasonably well in that. It is something we do on an annual basis, and obviously the people that do that penetration test for us keep up with latest threats, so they will constantly be updating the software that they use to carry out that penetration test each time they do it. We haven't updated the risk, as Councillor Musk says. We haven't changed the scoring, but again, as I said, this is a living document. If colleagues in IT advise us that circumstances have changed and that the likelihood or impact scores needed to be updated, it's something that we would look at as part of the quarterly review process.
Councillor Mercer again.
And secondly, related to what the leader said, I don't know if you heard the chief medical officer on Radio 4 today, who essentially said they didn't really know what was going to happen. But if things did get slightly out of control, I think it's fairly likely that the government would quickly push through an amendment. I think it's the 1974 Local Government Act, which says you have to be present at meetings. We have the ability through Office 365 to do video conferencing, but that bit of it has been disabled. Is that something which could be fairly quickly implemented so that we wouldn't have to go through a long teething process in order to do video conferencing council meetings?
I'm not an IT expert. I assume if it's something our IT colleagues have switched off, it can quite easily be switched on. Again, it's something I'm going to have to check and get back to Cabinet on. The other issue on the emerging coronavirus situation, we are obviously part of the Local Resilience Partnership and the Local Resilience Forum. They are participating in, at the moment, I think it's bi-weekly national call, so we are being kept up to date on the emerging situation, and we will obviously be working with our fellow authorities across Leicestershire, Leicester and Rutland in relation to the emerging situation as it carries on developing. Sorry, just to clarify, it's the 1972 Local Government Act.
I always love it when people out-nerd each other. I think it's very, very good. I'm very, very proud of you, Adrian, to know precisely. Look, good points to raise. Let's hope that we never have to get to the point where they're enacted, but I think better to be prepared, and that's obviously what the Strategic Risk Register is about, was actually raising questions, analysing the risk, assessing whether it's likely, and then scoring it appropriately. So points that we should always update on a regular basis. Any other further questions? Otherwise, I'm going to ask Councillor Poland to go to the... Oh, Councillor Smidovich, you've got a late one.
It's just that I just wondered with who's around as to whether the bunker
is still there and whether the officers will be decamped there and hunkering down.
Councillor Smidowitz, that's my personal bunker. Thank you very much. So I only allow the deputy leader to attend to me and the chief exec for occasional meetings. So Councillor Poland, can I ask you to make a proposal before anyone quizzes me?
I didn't actually know we had a bunker. This is,
there's tea cakes in there, though.
Is there really?
Tea cakes in there.
Yay. Okay. Well, that's good to know. Cool. Can I move recommendations 1 and 2 on page 125 for reasons 1 and 2 also on page 125?
Thank you very much. Can I ask Councillor Harper-Davis to second?
Yes, thank you. I'd like to second that item. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Can I see all of those in favour? And that's everyone, including Councillor Mercer's hand. It moves at lightning speed. Thank you very much. Oh, I see. Okay. He hasn't had an invite to my personal bunker. Okay, so we're on to item 12, with the Regulation of Investigatory Powers Act, more commonly known as RIPA. It's Policy and Review 2019. Councillor Poland, if I can ask you to introduce the report.
Thank you, Leader. Once again, an annual item. Once again, we haven't used RIPA in the last 12 months.
Thank you very much. Now, we have a question from Councillor Rawlings.
Thank you. I was just going to ask about whether or not, as a council, we are nervous about using this power, because I know certainly of one occasion in a ward close to me where there was definitely the potential for us to put in place some form of surveillance to investigate a potential crime, and it wasn't taken up. And I know that this report comes back to Cabinet very often with just a nil return each year. And I just wonder, what is our appetite for actually using this? Because, of course, it shouldn't stop us using it. It's meant to just make sure we do it properly. So I'm just wondering what the Council's position is on that.
Through you, Leader. I think, as explained on paragraph 5 in part B of the report, there are only certain circumstances in which we can use RIPA. And the main one that applies to us as a district council is we can only use it where there is a potential criminal offence which could attract a potential custodial sentence of 6 months or more. So we can't use it for minor offences. We can only use it for quite serious things. RIPA only also does apply to covert surveillance, so it's only when we're not making it clear to people that we are carrying out surveillance. I am aware that we do carry out a number of exercises where it's overt. So we have done in particular areas where there are littering problems, where we've gone out with CCTV, but we've made it clear to people that there's an operation in progress. We've alerted people to it, so it's therefore overt. And you'll be amazed the number of people who will drive. I won't name the particular restaurant premises, but it's a well-known burger restaurant with a drive-through. And we did not in the recent past, but within the last few years, we had big signs on all the entrances to the car park saying littering operation in progress, covert, you know, CCTV cameras in operation, and we still caught people dropping litter. So, but we do carry out overt surveillance. RIPA only applies in covert situations. It only applies where there's custodial sentence for 6 months, and we also would have to get a magistrate to approve it if we did wish to use RIPA provisions.
Councillor Rawlings, follow on.
Yeah, just a little follow on from that. I just wonder, are or what level of officers are aware of the powers, and at what point would it get referred to you to make a decision as to whether it's appropriate to apply? I just wonder whether, if you know, certain parts of the council maybe aren't fully aware of what is available to them, and I just wonder what training officers are given about the legislation.
So we do provide periodic training updates to the officers who are most likely to be in a position where they may use covert surveillance, so antisocial behaviour officers, environmental health officers, and the other people have escaped my mind, but for the
senior
moment...
Officers.
Sorry?
Senior officers.
Senior officers as well. We are actually, in a few weeks' time, running a RIPA update course, so I have identified the relevant teams that may benefit from that training. Their heads of service have been contacted and they've been asked to put those officers forward for the RIPA update training to make sure people are aware of the process to follow, but also to make sure officers don't fall foul inadvertently by carrying out covert surveillance without the proper required authorisation, which may put us in a weaker position. And if we did ever progress a prosecution case forward to court, and we hadn't gone through the proper RIPA authorisation processes.
Chief Exec.
Thank you, through you, Leader. The other scenario, I think, which often plays out in these circumstances is that the problem that we're looking at is often a multi-agency one working with the police or other partners. And quite often, in my experience, the police will take on perhaps the element of surveillance being more regular in terms of their use of it than we are. So quite often in a conversation with partners about a particular case, the police will undertake certain aspects of it which would otherwise fall to us, but perhaps they're sometimes better placed in terms of their experience.
Any other further questions? Councillor Smitherich.
Yes, I'm quite interested in this one, particularly with the detecting crime, because we have put 10 CCTV little monitors on fly-tipping areas that are fairly popular. But thinking back to the Shepshed one that hit the press recently with all the canisters, and this morning's email that came through from, I think it was the LGA, on the amount of tipping and illegal waste that companies are actually now discharging across borders, county borders and so on. I mean, the fines can go up to 50,000 and something along those lines could be imprisonable. And I just feel with it's now hitting the headlines in quite a increasing number of cases, that it's a big business for some of the these setups. I can't name a company in particular, that it's getting quite serious. And I know it's increasing in Charnwood Borough. So for me, it's the detecting crime and that aspect.
Point taken. Thank you very much. So if there are no other questions or comments, I'm going to ask Councillor Poland to make a proposal.
Can I move recommendations 1 to 3 for reasons 1 to 3, all on page 133?
Thank you very much. I'm going to ask Councillor Taylor to second.
I'm happy to second, Leader.
Can I see all of those in favour? Everyone. Thank you. That concludes this evening's Cabinet meeting. Thank you very much for everyone. Councillor Gerrard, thank you very much for being our witness to this evening. And I wish you all good night. Thank you.